BBC World Service. Play of the Week marks the 250th anniversary of Johann Wolfgang von Goethe's birth with an adaptation of his classic tragic novel, published in 1774 to enormous acclaim. The Sorrows of Young Werther follows the fortunes of a young artist whose passion for life and love threaten to overwhelm him.
A neighbor saw the flash of powder and heard the shot, but since everything remained quiet, he thought no more about it. Next morning at 6 o'clock, the servant came in with a candle. He found his master on the floor, saw the pistol and blood, called out and shook him. But Werther made no reply and merely groaned. The servant ran to fetch a doctor and Albert. Lotte heard the doorbell being pulled and a shudder went through her. When the surgeon reached the unfortunate man, he found him on the floor beyond hope. His pulse was still beating, but his limbs were powerless. He had shot himself above the right eye, blowing out his brains.
The Sorrows of Young Werther by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Michael Hulse, with Tom Goodman Hill as Werther.
Fourth of May, 1771. How happy I am to be away. My dear Wilhelm, will you be so good as to tell my mother I shall deal with her business as well as I can, and will give her news of it very soon. For the rest, I feel most contented here. Solitude is precious balm to my heart in these paradisic parts, and the abundance of this youthful season gives warmth to a heart that is oft to tremble with horror. Every tree, every hedgerow is a posy of blossoms, and one could wish to be a cockchafer, floating in a sea of wonderful scents and finding all one's nourishment there. 13th of May. You ask if you should send my books. My dear fellow, I implore you, for God's sake, keep the things from me. I do not want to be led on, stimulated, inspired any more, for this heart of mine is turbulent enough of its own accord. What I need is soothing lullabies, and I have found them in abundance in my Homer. How often do I lull my tumultuous blood to rest, for you have seen nothing as changeably unquiet as this heart. Dear friend, do I need to tell you that, you who have so often endured seeing me pass from sorrow to excessive joy, from sweet melancholy to destructive passion? And I am treating my poor heart like an ailing child. Every whim is granted. 17th of May. If you ask how the people are here, I have to answer, just as they are everywhere. The human race is a monotonous affair. Most people spend the greatest part of their time working in order to live, and what little freedom remains so fills them with fear that they seek out any and every means to be rid of it. What a thing our human destiny is. There is a worthy man I have now got to know, the manager of the royal estate, an open man, of good heart. They say it brings joy to the spirit to see him among his children, 9 of them. His eldest daughter, in particular, is highly spoken of. He has invited me to his home, and I mean to visit him in the very near future. He lives in a royal hunting lodge, 1.5 hours from here, where he was given permission to move after the death of his wife, as he found it too painful to remain here in town, in the official residence. 26th of May. You know of old my way of making myself a home, of pitching my humble shelter in some pleasant place and lodging there in the most modest of manners. Here, too, I have once again been attracted to such a spot. About 1 hour outside the town is a place they call Valheim. It is most engagingly situated on a hill, and when you are up above and following the path out of the village, you suddenly have a view across the entire valley. A kindly innkeeper, obliging and cheerful in her old age, has wine, beer, and coffee to offer. And best of all are the 2 linden trees, whose spreading boughs shade the little church square, which is surrounded by farmers' houses, barns, and yards. It has not been easy to find so pleasant and cozy a spot. And now I have my little table and chair carried out of the inn, and drink my coffee there, and read my Homer. 16th of June. Why have I not written to you? In a word, I have made an acquaintance who has touched my heart very closely. I have... I know not what. An angel! Rot. Every man says that about his beloved, does he not? and yet I am unable to tell you how and why she is perfection itself. Suffice to say that she has captivated me utterly. So much simplicity, with so much understanding, so much goodness and so much resolve, and tranquility of soul together with true life and vitality. Everything I'm telling you about her is fearful twaddle, tiresome abstractions that do not express a single trait of her being. Some other time. No, not another time. I shall tell it you right now. If I don't do so now, I never will. Recently, I wrote that I had become acquainted with the estate officer, who invited me to visit him soon at his retreat, or rather in his little kingdom. I neglected to do so, and perhaps would never have gone if chance had not revealed to me the treasure that lies concealed in those peaceful parts. The young people here had arranged a ball out in the country, and I gladly agreed to be one of the party. I asked one of the local girls, a good, pretty, and otherwise insignificant girl, to be my companion, and we planned that I should take a carriage and drive out to the scene of the festivities with my dancing partner and her aunt, picking up Charlotte on the way. "Be on your guard," put in the aunt, "and take care not to fall in love." "Why?" I asked. "She is already promised to a very worthy man," she replied, "who has gone away to put his affairs in order following the death of his father and to see about a decent position." The sun was still a quarter hour from touching the mountains as we drove up at the gate of the courtyard. It was very sultry, and the ladies voiced fears of the thunderstorm that appeared to be approaching on the horizon, where dank, whitish-grey clouds were gathering. I had got down, and the maid who came to the gate asked for a moment's indulgence and said Mademoiselle Lottchen would be with us right away. I crossed the courtyard to a well-built house and, climbing the flight of steps in front, opened the door and beheld the most charming scene I have ever set eyes on. In the hallway, 6 children, aged between 11 and 2, were milling about a girl with a wonderful figure and of medium height, wearing a simple white dress with pink ribbons at the sleeves and breast. She was holding a loaf of rye bread and cutting a piece for each of the little ones about her, according to their age and appetite. She handed out the slices with great kindliness, and the children reached up their little hands long before the bread was cut, cried their artless thanks, and then either bounded away contented with their supper, or, in the case of the quieter ones, walked tranquilly out to the courtyard gate to look at the strangers and the carriage in which their Lotta was to drive away. "Do forgive me for putting you to the trouble of coming in," she said.
"And for keeping the ladies waiting. What with dressing and seeing that all will be well in the house in my absence, I forgot to give my children their supper, and they won't have their bread cut by anyone but me."
I paid her some unimportant compliment. My entire soul was transfixed by her figure, her tone, her manner. And I barely had time to recover from my surprise when she ran into the parlor to fetch her gloves and fan. The 2 eldest boys had clambered onto the back of the carriage, and at my request, she allowed them to ride with us as far as the woods, as long as they promised not to get up to any mischief and to hold on tight. We had scarcely settled in our seats, and the ladies had hardly greeted each other, passed comments on each other's attire, and especially their hats, than Lotta had the coachman stop and her brothers get down. They then desired to kiss her hand once again, which the elder did with all the tenderness of a 15-year-old, and the other with considerable vehemence and abandon. She sent her love to the little ones once again, and we drove on. The talk turned to the pleasures of dancing.
"Even if it is wrong to have a passion for it, I gladly confess that there is nothing I like better than dancing. And if I am worried about something, I hammer out a country dance on my out-of-tune piano and everything is all right again."
Knowing me as you do, you can imagine how I delighted in her dark eyes during this conversation, how my entire soul was drawn to her young lips and fresh, bright cheeks, and how I was so absorbed in the splendid meaning of her words that I scarcely registered the way she expressed herself. In short, when we drew up before the house, I got down from the carriage as if in a dream, and was so lost in dreams in that dusky world that I hardly heard the music that sounded across from the brightly lit ballroom above. Never in all my life have I danced so well. I was no longer a mere mortal, holding the most adorable of creatures in my arms and flying about with her like lightning, so that I forgot everything about me. And, Wilhelm, to be honest, I swore that a girl I loved and had a claim on should never waltz with anyone but me, not even if it cost me my life. You take my meaning. We were the second couple in the third English country dance. As we were going down the row, and I, with God knows how great an ecstasy, was gazing at her arms and eyes, which were alive with the warmth of the purest, most genuine pleasure, we passed a woman who had struck me on account of her amiable expression, though her face was no longer quite young. She looked at Lotta with a smile, raised a warning finger, and as she flew by, uttered the name Albert, twice, and in a very significant tone.
"Who is Albert?"
I said to Lotta. She was about to answer when we were obliged to separate to dance the grand figure of eight, and I thought I saw signs of pensiveness on her brow as we crossed each other's paths. "Why should I hide it from you?" she said, as she gave me her hand for the promenade.
"Albert is a dear, honest man to whom I am as good as engaged."
"Albert is a dear, honest man to whom I am as good as engaged." Now, this was no news to me, since the girls had told me on the way, yet nonetheless, it was utterly new to me, as I had not yet connected the thought with her, who had come in so short a time to mean so much to me. In brief, I was confused, forgot what I was at, and blundered into the wrong couple, so that everything was in disarray, and Lotta's entire presence of mind and tugging and pulling were needed to restore a hasty order. The dance had not yet finished when the lightning, which we had seen flaring on the horizon for some time, and which I had pronounced to be merely sheet lightning, began to flash more violently, and the thunder to drown out the music. Three ladies fled the rows, followed by their gentlemen. The confusion became general, and the music ceased. Lotta was busy setting out a circle of chairs, and once the company was seated, as she requested, she proposed that we play a game. It was a hilarious sight. She went round the circle with her arms stretched out. "One," began the first. "Two," said his neighbour. "Three," the next, and so forth. Then she began to go faster and faster, till one missed his number. Smack, his ears were boxed, and amidst the laughter came the next. Smack. I myself was slapped twice, and took great pleasure in supposing them heartier slaps than she gave the others. The game dissolved into all-round laughter and merriment before we had reached 1,000. The storm had passed over, and I followed Lotta into the ballroom. We went to the window. The thunder was passing by, and a wonderful rain was falling on the land, filling the warm air with the most refreshing fragrance. She stood there, resting on her elbows, gazing deep into the country about us. She looked at the heavens and at me, and I saw there were tears in her eyes. It was more than I could bear. I bowed over her hand and kissed it, shedding tears of the greatest joy, and once again looked up to gaze into her eyes. What happened during the drive home from the ball I have not yet told you, nor have I the time to do so today. It was the most marvelous of sunrises. Raindrops were dripping in the woods, and the countryside all around us was refreshed. I took my leave of her, first asking if I might see her later the same day. She consented, and I went. And since then, the sun and moon and stars can go about their business as they please. But as for me, I do not know if it is day or night, and the whole world is as nothing to me. 21st of June. My days are as happy as any God sets aside for his saints, and whatever the future may have in store for me, I cannot claim I have not enjoyed the pleasures of life, the very purest of pleasures. You know my Valheim. I am quite at home there now, and from there it is only half an hour to Lotta, and I take pleasure in myself and all the happiness that can be mad. I am not deceiving myself. I can read a genuine interest in me and my fate in those dark eyes of hers. Yes, I can feel that she loves me. She loves me, and I have grown in stature in my own eyes.
She is sacred to me.
All my desires are stilled in her presence. I never know what I am about when I am with her. It is as if my very soul were throbbing.
I shall see her today.
I exclaim in the mornings when I rise and look up to the beautiful sun with a glad heart. I shall see her today. And then I have not other wishes all day long. Everything. I have never felt happier, and my feelings for nature, down to tiny pebbles and blades of grass, have never been so full and acute, and yet I do not know how to express myself. I have started on a portrait of Lotta 3 times, and 3 times I have failed disgracefully. Which depresses me all the more, since I could take a very good likeness not so long ago. So then I cut a silhouette profile of her. And that will have to
be often determined not to see her so frequently.
But who could abide by such a decision? Every day I give in to temptation and take my sacred oath that I shall stay away on the morrow. And once the next day comes, I hit upon some irresistible reason again, and in no time at all I am at her side. Or else, it is a fine day, and I walk to Valheim, and once I am there, it is only another 30 minutes to Lotta's. I am too close to her magic realm. Snap your fingers, and there I am. My grandmother used to tell a story about a magnetic mountain. Ships that sailed too close were suddenly stripped of all their ironwork, the nails flew to the mountain, and the wretched travellers perished in the falling timbers. 30th of July. Albert has arrived, and I shall leave. Even if he were the best and noblest of men, one to whom I should be willing to think myself inferior in every respect, it would be unbearable to see him before me, in possession of such perfections. Possession! Enough, dear Wilhelm. Her intended is here. A dear and honest man whom one cannot help liking. Fortunately, I was not present when she welcomed him home. And anyway, I cannot help esteeming Albert. His tranquil evenness of manner is in marked contrast to the turbulence of my own disposition, which I cannot hide. He considers me a man of some sensitivity, and his own triumph is augmented by my attachment to Lotta, and the joyful warmth her every action produces in me, and he loves her all the more. Between you and me, I keep a careful watch for times when he is busy elsewhere, and whoosh, there I am. And I'm always happy to find her on her own. 8th of August. You say that I can either hope to win Lotta or give up my hopes. Very well. In the former case, try to press on and attain the fulfillment of your wishes, and in the latter, pull yourself together and try to shake off the miserable emotions that can only wear your powers away. Dear friend, well said. But how easily it is said. Would you insist that some wretch, whose life is slowly but surely being drained away by lingering disease, put an end to his miseries with one sharp thrust of his dagger? Does not the malady that consumes his strength also rob him of the courage to seek deliverance? Enough. Wilhelm, I have moments of courage when I could leap to my feet and shrug it all off. Moments when, if only I knew where to go, I should be on my way. 12th of August. No doubt about it, Albert is the best fellow on earth. Yesterday the two of us had a remarkable scene. I called on him to take my leave, for I was in the mood for riding out into the hills, which is where I am writing from now. As I was pacing up and down his room, I noticed his pistols. Send me your pistols, I said, for my journey. By all means, said he, if you will take the trouble to load them. I only have them there pro forma. I took one of them down, and he continued. My caution backfired on me quite nastily, and ever since I have wanted nothing to do with such things. I was curious to hear the story. For a good 3 months, he told me, I was staying in the country at a friend's, and I had a brace of pistols with me, which I kept unloaded and slept well. Then one rainy afternoon, when I was sitting about doing nothing, for some reason it occurred to me that we might be attacked, we might need the pistols, we might... You know how it is. I gave them to the servant to clean and load, and he was fooling about with the maid, trying to scare her, when, God knows how, the gun went off, with the ramrod still in the barrel, and shot the rod straight through the girl's right hand, smashing her thumb. So I got all the weeping and wailing and had the doctor's bill to pay as well, and since then I have kept all my guns unloaded. My dear chap, what use is caution? We cannot anticipate every possible danger, but still... On this occasion, Albert preached a veritable sermon, and finally I ceased to listen to him, fell to brooding, and suddenly placed the mouth of the pistol against my forehead, above my right eye. "What are you playing at?" said Albert, taking the pistol from me. "It isn't loaded," I said. "Even if it isn't," he retorted impatiently, "what are you up to? I cannot imagine how a man can be so foolish as to shoot himself. I find the mere thought repellent." "Why is it?" I demanded. "But when people speak of things, they must promptly pronounce them foolish or clever, or wicked or good. Whatever does it all mean? Have you really grasped the true and inmost nature of an action? Can you really give a definite account of the reasons why it happened and why it had to happen? If you understood them, you might not judge so hastily." "But you will grant that certain actions are wrongful," said Albert, "no matter what their motives." I shrugged and conceded the point. "And yet, my dear friend," I went on, "there are exceptions to that rule, too. True, it is wrong to steal, but if a man goes thieving to save himself and his family from starvation, are we to pity him or punish him? Or if a girl abandons herself for one joyful hour to the irresistible pleasures of love? Even our laws, cold-blooded and pedantic as they are moved to relent and forego punishment." "That is entirely different," answered Albert. "Because a man wholly under the influence of his passions has lost his ability to think rationally and is regarded as intoxicated or insane." "Ah, you sensible people," I cried with a smile. "Passions, intoxication, insanity. You are so calm and collected, so indifferent, you respectable people, tut-tutting about drunkenness and holding unreasonable behavior in contempt. I have been intoxicated more than once. My passions have never been far off insanity, and I have no regrets, because I have come to realize, in my own way, that people have always felt a need to decry the extraordinary men who accomplish great things, things that seemed impossible, as intoxicated and insane." "These are your usual fanciful thoughts," said Albert. "You exaggerate everything, and in this case at least you are certainly wrong to compare suicide, which is what we were talking about, with great accomplishments, since it cannot be considered as anything but a weakness. After all, it is easier to die than to endure a harrowing life with fortitude." "Human nature has its limits," I said, "and can take joys, sorrows, and pain up to a certain point, but is annihilated once the threshold is crossed. The question, therefore, is not whether a man is weak or strong, but whether he can endure the full extent of his sufferings, be they of a moral or physical nature. And, in my opinion, it would be as misconceived to call a man cowardly for taking his own life as it would be to say a man who dies of a malignant fever was a coward." We parted, without either having understood the other. But then, it is never easy for men to understand each other in this world. 21st of August. In vain I stretch out my arms to her when morning comes, and I gradually waken from deep dreams. In vain I look for her in my bed at night when some happy, innocent reverie has tricked me into believing I was sitting with her in a meadow, holding her hand and covering it with a thousand kisses. Ah, still half asleep, I reach for her, cheered to think she is there. And a flood of tears pours from my sorely beset heart, and I weep inconsolably over my somber future. 22nd of August. It is quite disastrous, Wilhelm. All my active energies have been cast down into restless listlessness, and I can neither be idle nor accomplish anything. My imagination has deserted me. My feeling for nature is gone, and books nauseate me. Once we are lost unto ourselves, everything else is lost to us. I swear there are times when I wish I could be a day laborer, simply in order to have something to look forward to in the day ahead, a sense of purpose, hope. I often envy Albert when I see him up to the ears in paperwork, and fancy I should be content if I were in his position. I have repeatedly been on the point of writing to you and the minister, applying for the embassy appointment which you assure me I would obtain. I too believe I would do so. The minister has a long-standing regard for me and has often urged me to devote myself to some business. And for one brief hour, I am on the brink of going ahead. But then, when I consider it anew, and the story of the horse that grew weary of freedom, had itself saddled and bridled, and was ridden into the ground, occurs to me, I do not know what to do. 28th of August. Today is my birthday, and early in the morning, a package arrived from Albert. When I opened it, the first thing I set eyes on was one of the pink ribbons Lotta was wearing when I met her, which I had often asked her for since then. I have been kissing that bow 1,000 times over, and with every breath I take, the memory of those few happy, irrecoverable days returns to me. 3rd of September. I must leave. Thank you, Wilhelm, for stiffening my wavering resolve. This last fortnight, I have been thinking of leaving her. I must go. She is in town again with a friend, and Albert, and I must go. 10th of September. What a night that was. Now, Wilhelm, I can endure anything. I shall never see her again. Ah, she will be sleeping peacefully, without a suspicion that she will never see me again. I have torn myself away, and I had the fortitude not to betray my intention during a 2-hour talk. And my God, what a talk it was. We had just emerged onto the terrace when the moon rose above the wooded hill. We spoke of various things, and, without noticing it, approached the melancholy summer house. Lotta stepped inside and sat down. Albert sat beside her, and so did I, but I was too agitated to sit for long. I got to my feet, stood before her, paced to and fro, sat down again. I was in a fearful state. She drew our attention to the beautiful effect of the moonlight, which was illuminating the entire terrace beyond the beech trees. A glorious sight, which was rendered all the more striking by the deep gloom which enclosed us on all sides. We remained silent, and after a while she observed,
I can never ever go walking in the moonlight without the thought of my dear departed ones coming to my mind, or without being filled with a sense of death and what lies in the future. There will be a life for us after death, Werther. But will we find each other again and know each other? What do you suppose? What do you say?
Lotta, I said, giving her my hand, my eyes filling with tears.
We shall see each other again. We shall meet again, both here and in the hereafter.
I was unable to continue. Did she have to put that question, Wilhelm, with my heart burdened with the dreadful parting to come?
What of our dear departed ones? Do they know how we are? Can they sense when things go well with us? Can they feel that we remember them with fond love? The figure of my mother is always by me when I sit amidst her children in the silent evening hours. Amidst my children. And they crowd about as they used to crowd about her. Then I shed a tear of longing and raised my eyes to heaven and wished that she could look down for one moment and see that I am keeping the promise I made at the hour of her death, to be a mother to her children. With what emotion I then cry out, dear mother. Forgive me if I cannot be to them what you were.
Lotta, I exclaimed, falling at her feet, seizing her hand and shedding a thousand tears on it. Lotta, God's blessing and the spirit of your mother are upon you.
If only you had known her,
she said, squeezing my hand.
She was worthy of being known by you.
I thought it would be the end of me. Nobody had ever paid me a greater or prouder compliment. She stood up, and I, both moved and devastated, remained seated, holding her hand. It is time we were going, she said. She tried to withdraw her hand, but I held it more tightly. We shall see each other again, I cried. We shall find each other. We shall pick each other out from among the many. I am going, going of my own free will, yet...
You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is WNYE New York.
Farewell, Lotta. Farewell, Albert. We shall meet again. Tomorrow, I expect, she countered in jest. They left the avenue, and I stood watching them in the moonlight, threw myself on the ground and wept my heart out, then leapt to my feet and ran out onto the terrace from where, down below in the shade of the tall linden trees, I could still make out the white gleam of her dress as she walked to the garden gate, and I stretched out my arms, and she vanished. October 20th. I arrived here yesterday. The ambassador is indisposed and will therefore be staying indoors for a few days. If only he were not so morose, all would be well. I can see all too clearly that fate has severe trials in store for me. But courage, a light-hearted spirit can put up with anything. A light heart makes me laugh. The way the words flow from my pen. Oh, if there were a little more light-heartedness in my veins, I should be the happiest creature under the sun. 26th of November. I am beginning to find things quite tolerable here, on the whole. Best of all is that I am kept well occupied, and these many and various people, all the new characters, provide my soul with a colourful spectacle. I have struck up an acquaintance with Count C, whom I esteem more highly every day, a man of great learning and mature judgment, but by no means cold, thanks to his broad understanding. In his company, I feel that he is very sensitive to friendship and love. There is no truer, warmer pleasure in this world than to behold a great soul opening up towards oneself. 24th of December. The ambassador is extremely trying, as I foresaw. He is the most punctilious oaf imaginable, doing everything step by step, meticulous as a maiden aunt, a man whom it is impossible to satisfy because he is never satisfied with himself. And this glittering misery, the tedium of these awful people cooped up together here, and their greed for rank, and the way they are forever watchful and alert for gain or precedence, the most wretched and abominable of passions, quite nakedly displayed. 20th of January, 1772. I have to write to you, my dear Lotta, from the parlour of this humble country inn, where I have taken refuge from a dreadful storm. As long as I was in that miserable hole, living among strangers who were alien to my heart, I never had time, not a single moment, when my heart might have prompted me to write to you. And now, in this cottage, isolated and confined, with snow and hail beating against the little window, my thoughts turn to you, first of all. If you could but see me, my dear friend, amidst the whirl of trivial amusements. My senses are quite dried out. There is not a single instant when the heart is full, not one single hour of bliss. Nothing. I have met only one female creature here, one Miss von B. who resembles you, my dear Lotte. If it is possible to resemble you. She has a great soul, which gazes straight at one from her blue eyes. Her rank is a burden and satisfies none of the wishes of her heart. She is longing to put all this brouhaha behind her, and we spend many an hour imagining country scenes of unadulterated bliss. And then, we speak of you. Oh, if only I was sitting at your feet in that dear familiar little room with the dear little ones romping about me. If they were too loud for your liking, I would gather them round me and keep them quiet with some frightful fairy tale. Adieu. Is Albert with you? And what? God forgive these questions. February 20. I'm grateful to you, Albert, for deceiving me. I was waiting for news of your wedding date and had decided to take down Lotta's silhouette profile from my wall on that day, with all solemnity, and bury it amidst my other papers. So now you are married, and her picture is still there. Well, so be it. And why not? I know that I am still with you, that your position is unaffected, dear Albert, by my place in Lotta's heart, that indeed I hold second place in her heart, and wish to keep it, must keep it. Oh, it would drive me insane if she could forget. Albert, the very thought is hell. Albert, farewell. Farewell, thou angel of heaven. Farewell, Lotta. 15 March. This latest adversity will drive me away from here. As you know, Count C is fond of me and accords me special favor. I dined with him yesterday, the very day when the ladies and gentlemen of the nobility regularly assemble at his house in the evening. It never crossed my mind, nor did it occur to me, that we subordinates do not belong in that company. I dined with the Count, and afterwards we walked up and down the great hall in conversation. Then in came the most gracious Lady von S, with her spouse and her scheming little goose of a flat-chested, trimly corseted daughter, and in passing they gave me looks and twitched their nostrils in their usual oh-so-aristocratic way. And since I cannot abide this breed, I was about to take my leave, and was just waiting for the Count to disengage himself from their appalling twaddle, when my Miss von B entered the hall. My heart always feels freer the moment I see her, so I stationed myself behind her chair, and did not notice until some time had passed that she was speaking less openly than normally, and with a certain embarrassment. It was striking. Can she too be like the rest of them? I wondered, vexed. I did not register that the women were whispering at the far end of the hall, that the whispering was spreading to the men, or that Mrs. von S. was speaking to the Count. Miss von B. told me all this afterwards, until at length the Count approached me, and took me aside in the bay of the window. You know how absurd things are, he said. I gather the company takes exception to your presence here. I should not wish on any account, Your Excellency, I interrupted. I beg 1,000 pardons. I should have thought of it sooner, but I trust you will forgive the oversight. I had intended to take my leave some time ago, but my wicked demon prevented me, I added, smiling and bowing. The Count shook my hand feelingly, in a manner that spoke volumes. I made my inconspicuous disappearance from the illustrious assembly, and left, took a two-wheeler, and drove out to stand on the hill and watch the sunset and read that magnificent book in Homer, where Odysseus enjoys the hospitality of the excellent swineherd, which was all very pleasant. 16 March. Everything is conspiring against me. Today I met Miss von B. in the avenue and could not resist talking to her, and as soon as we were some distance from the company, indicating how deeply her recent behavior had affected me. Oh, Werther, she said in a tone of fervent emotion. Surely you know my heart could not interpret my distress in such a way. How I suffered on your account from the very second I entered the hall. I saw it all coming, and 100 times I was on the point of telling you. I knew that the ladies and their menfolk would rather leave than remain in your company, and I knew the Count has to stay in favor with them. And now all this talk. Every word she said was like a dagger in my heart. She did not sense what a mercy it would have been to keep it all from me, and she went on to predict the kind of gossip that was still to come. To hear all this from her. Dear Wilhelm, in a tone of the sincerest sympathy. I felt annihilated and am still in a rage within. 24th of March. I have tendered my resignation to the court and hope it will be accepted. You must forgive me, Wilhelm, for not having first asked your consent, but it has become imperative that I leave, and I know everything you would say to persuade me to stay, so... Break the news gently to my mother. There is nothing I can do about it, and she will needs be resigned to my being unable to ease the shock for her either. Of course, it is bound to hurt her to see her son's admirable career to the office of Privy Councillor and then Ambassador so rudely interrupted, and her son marching back to the stables with the other animals. Well, make of it what you will, and analyze the possible conditions under which I could or should have stayed. The fact of it is that I am leaving, and, so that you know where I am moving to, the Prince is here, and takes great pleasure in my company. And having heard of my intention, he has asked me to spend the spring on his estate with him. 11th of June. Say what you please, I cannot stay here any longer. What am I to do here? Time hangs heavy on my hands. I shall remain another week and then start on my wanderings once more. 18th of June. Where am I going? I shall tell you, in confidence. I only want to be near to Lotta again, that's all. And... I laugh at this heart of mine and do as it dictates. Third of September. At times, I cannot grasp that she can love another man, that she dare love another man, when I love her, and her alone, with such passion and devotion, and neither know nor have anything but her. 6th of September. It cost me a wrench, but in the end I decided not to wear the simple blue frock coat I had on when I first danced with Lotta anymore. It had become quite unpresentable. Still, I have had a new one made, exactly like the other, down to the collar and lapels, and the very same buff waistcoat and breeches as well. 19th of October. This void, this terrible void I feel in my breast. I often think that if only I could hold her to my heart for once, just once, that void would be entirely filled. 27th of October. I have so much, and my feelings for her absorb it all. I have so much, and without her it is all nothing. 3rd of November. God knows, I often retire to my bed, wishing at times, even hoping, that I might never wake up. And in the mornings, I open my eyes, see the sun once again, and am miserable. 21st of November. What is the meaning of the kindly look with which she sometimes, gazes at me? Or of the sweetness of temper with which she receives my involuntary outbreaks of feeling, or of the sympathy for my sorrows that I see in her expression. 4th of December. I beg you, It is all over with me, Wilhelm. I cannot stand it any longer. Today, I was sitting with her. I sat there, and she was playing the piano, various melodies, and all of it so expressive. Her little sister was dressing her doll on my knee. The tears came to my eyes. I bent forward, and my eye was caught by her wedding ring, and the tears flowed, and all of a sudden, she began to play that old tune, so full of divine sweetness, quite suddenly, and my soul was filled with a sense of solace, and with memories of past times when I heard that air, and of the dejected gloom and disappointed hopes since those times, and I paced to and fro in the parlor, my heart smothering in its affliction. "For God's sake," I said, fiercely stepping towards her. "Stop it! For God's sake!" She stopped playing and stared at me. "Werther," she said with a smile that pierced my soul. "You are ill, Werther? Very ill. You cannot stomach your favorite dishes. Go, I implore you, and calm down." I tore myself away. "And dear God, thou seest my misery and wilt make an end of it." 14th of December. What does it mean, dear friend? I alarm myself. Is not my love for her the most sacred, purest, and most brotherly love? Have I ever harbored reprehensible desires in my soul? Lotta! Lotta! Is it all over with me? My senses are confused. For a full week, I have been unable to think straight. My eyes are full of tears. Nowhere do I feel at ease, and yet I am content. Everywhere. I wish for nothing and make no demand. It would be better if I were gone. 20th of December. I thank you for the love you show, dear Wilhelm, in picking up my words. Yes, you are right. It would be better if I were gone. I am not entirely pleased by your proposal that I return to stay with you. I welcome your plan to come and collect me, but perhaps you would delay for another fortnight and wait for another letter from me with further details. One ought not to pick the fruit before it is ripe. Be so good as to request my mother to pray for her son and tell her I beg her forgiveness for the distress I have caused her. It seems it has been my fate to sadden those I should have made happy. Farewell, my dearest friend. May heaven send you every blessing. Farewell.
On the same day that Werther wrote this letter to his friend, the Sunday before Christmas, he called on Lotte in the evening and found her alone.
"Can there really not be another girl in the whole wide world to satisfy the longings of your heart? Take a grip on yourself and go in search of her, and I swear you will find her. I have for some time been worried on your account and ours by the narrow confinement you have imposed on yourself of late. Go on your travels. It will and must take your mind off things. Seek someone who is worthy of your love. Find her. And then return, and we shall enjoy the happiness of true friendship together."
Monday, 21st of December. "The decision is taken, Lotta. I am resolved to die.
It had been mentioned in Albert's presence, more or less in passing, that Werther would not be calling again before Christmas Eve.
And I am writing the words to you without any romantic hysteria, but calmly, on the morning of the day I shall see you for the last time.
And Albert had ridden out to see an official in the neighborhood with whom he had business to conduct.
When you read this, my precious, cool grave will already hold the rigid remains of the troubled unfortunate.
It was 6:30 by the time she heard Werther coming up the stairs.
Who can conceive of no sweeter pleasure in the final moments of his life than talking to you?
Her heart beat wildly upon his arrival. Indeed, it may not be too much to say it did so for the first time.
It is not despair. I am convinced I have endured my fill of sorrows and that I am sacrificing myself for you. Yes, Lotta, why should I not say it? One of us three must go. So let it be me. Oh, my dearest one. This broken heart of mine has often harbored furious thoughts of killing your husband, or you, or myself. So be it.
He sat down and read some of the songs of Ossian.
For the last time, then. For the last time, I open these eyes.
A flood of tears poured from Lotta's eyes. They could sense their own wretchedness in the fates of the noble heroes.
Lotta, it is an incomparable feeling. And yet it is like a half-waking dream.
Werther flung himself down before Lotta in deep despair. He clasped her in his arms and covered her trembling, murmuring lips with fiery kisses.
To say to myself, this is my last morning.
You will never see me again.
To die? When we speak of death, we are only dreaming.
Just a word of farewell.
Oh, forgive me. Forgive me. Yesterday, it ought to have been the very last moment in my life. For the first time, for the very first time, without any doubt at all, I was burning deep within, burning with joy, knowing she loves me.
About 11:00 the next day, Werther asked his servant if Albert had returned.
All of it passes away. But a whole eternity will not extinguish that living fire I enjoyed yesterday.
The servant replied that he had, since he had seen his horse led past.
And which I feel burning within me. She loves me.
At this, his master gave him an unsealed note to deliver.
These arms held her. These lips trembled against hers.
Which read as follows.
This mouth murmured upon hers. She is mine.
Would you be so kind as to lend me your pistols for a journey I'm about to make? Farewell.
Yes, Lotta. For all eternity.
The servant handed Albert the note, and the latter turned coolly to his wife and said, give him the pistols.
Albert is your husband. Well, what of it?
Slowly she went to the wall and took down the pistols with a shaking hand.
And in the eyes of the world, is it sinful for me to love you?
And hesitated. And would have hesitated longer if Albert had not hastened her with a questioning glance.
To want to tear you from his embrace into my own?
She handed the fateful implements to the servant and retired to her room in an inexpressible quandary.
They have been through your hands. You wiped the dust off them. I kissed them 1,000 times. You touched them.
After lunch, he told his servant to pack everything up.
Oh, I asked my servant every detail.
Tore up a great many papers and went out to settle a few small debts.
You shook as you handed them to him and bade me no farewell.
He returned at nightfall.
Have you closed your heart to me because of that moment that bound me to you forever?
He had the fire made up at 10.
Farewell. I am going to make an end of it.
And had a bottle of wine brought to him. Then dismissed his servant.
All around me is so silent, and my soul is so calm. I thank thee, God, for granting this warmth and strength in my last moments. This dear silhouette profile. I am leaving it to you, Lotta, and beg you to cherish it. I have implanted 1,000,000 kisses on it, and 1,000 times I have passed the time of day with it on leaving or returning home. I have written a note to your father requesting him to take my body into his protection. In the churchyard, there are 2 linden trees in the far corner near the field. That is where I should like to lie. He can do and will do this for a friend. I wish to be buried in these clothes, Lotta. You touched them and they are sacred. I have made the request of your father also. My soul will be keeping watch over my coffin. I do not want anyone going through my pockets. This pink ribbon you wore at your breast the first time I saw you amongst your children. Oh, give them 1,000 kisses and tell them the fate of your wretched friend. This ribbon is to be buried with me. You gave it me on my birthday. I could not get enough of it all. Ah, I little thought that my path was leading me this way. Be of peaceful heart, I implore you. Be of peaceful heart. They are loaded. It is striking 12. So be it. Lotta. Lotta. Farewell. Farewell.
A neighbor saw the flash of the powder and heard the shot. But since everything remained quiet, he thought no more about it. From the blood on the backrest of the chair, it could be deduced that he committed the deed sitting at his desk, then sank to the floor, thrashing convulsively about the chair. He was found lying on his back near the window, all strength gone, fully clothed, wearing his boots and his blue coat and buff waistcoat. It was 12 midday when he died. The presence of Lotta's father and the precautions he took prevented any disturbance. About 11 that night, he had him buried at a place that Vert had chosen for himself. The old gentleman and his sons followed the corpse, but Albert was unable to. There were fears for Lotta's life. Guildsmen bore the body. No priest attended him.
In The Sorrows of Young Werther by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, Werther was played by Tom Goodman Hill, Lotta, Casey Wilde, and the reporter, Johan Meredith. Technical presentation was by Simon Moorcroft, and the production assistant was Sarah Tomling. The Sorrows of Young Werther was adapted for radio and directed for the BBC World Service by Rosalind Ward.